This podcast is brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short. You can find more podcasts and other resources on our website, www.acamh.org, and follow us on social media by searching ACAMH.
Hello, welcome to the In Conversation podcast series for the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short. I'm Jo Carlo, a freelance journalist with a specialism in psychology. Today I'm interviewing Elaine Fox, Professor of Psychology and Affective Neuroscience at the University of Oxford. Elaine, welcome. Thanks for joining me. Can you start with an introduction about who you are and what
Great.
You do?
Well, first of all, thanks very much for inviting me. Jo, it's nice to be here. Well, as you said, I'm a professor of psychology at Oxford University, so I have a small research team. And my work really involves looking at, risk and protective factors around mental well-being. And more recently, I've become quite interested in adolescent mental health.
You're interested in the nature of human emotions, why people differ so much from each other and how they react to similar environmental situations. What got you interested?
I think I initially got interested actually back when I was doing my PhD, and I was actually working in a psychopharmacology unit. Mm-hmm. So we were looking at the effects of sedative drugs, so anti-anxiety drugs, and particularly with people going in for minor surgical procedures. So we were looking at the amnesic effect. And one of the things we needed to test prior to the study was whether people were actually becoming sedated or not, or relaxed before mm-hmm. the surgery. And obviously we had a placebo-controlled condition. Yeah. So some people got a dummy pill, some got the real pill. Everyone did get a drug before they actually went in for the procedure, but it was just a different time scale. And we were trained how to measure levels of sedation using a kind of anesthetic scale, really. And one of the measures is called ptosis, which is the drooping of the eye, how quickly the eyes droop. And it's something we shouldn't have done, but of course, as students, we always try to guess who had the placebo and who didn't. And of course, it's not good scientific practice, but the thing, I was absolutely astounded when finally we did break the code afterwards to find that some of the people who showed really deep physical signs of sedation, including this ptosis measure, actually had been on placebo. And wow. I became really kind of fascinated by that. And not only did that kind of fascinate me about the placebo effect generally, but also then realizing, just looking at the differences of how people responded to something as physical, if you like, as a drug. So, a drug where we know the mechanism of action pretty well, but actually some people are really sensitive and responded very strongly. Others didn't respond at all. And throughout my career then, I kind of moved away from psychopharmacology, but really maintained that interest in how we kind of differ in terms of both, I suppose, really bad things happening. So in adversity, how people differ in terms of how well they cope, but also when really good things happen. So if you win the lottery, not that I've studied many people winning the lottery, but, really good things. We all know people who absolutely get overly excited and, whereas other people, they kind of just take it in the stride, really. So I've just really been always fascinated by those kind of systematic individual differences.
Right. And what kinds of differences do you see between people in terms of their resilience on the one hand and their emotional vulnerability on the other?
Well, it's really interesting. I think one of the findings in the research more recently, actually, is just how many people are really resilient. And I think we hear in the media a lot about emotional vulnerability and anxiety and depression, which, quite understandably, these are major problems. I'm not in any way underestimating them. But actually, even after quite major problems and major setbacks, most people are actually quite resilient. But one of the things that the researchers really found is that there are lots of different pathways to resilience. So it's not that, there are some people who are simply resilient regardless and others who are vulnerable. It's very much different people find different pathways through, and there's lots of different coping strategies that will help, and in terms of, who becomes more resilient and who becomes less resilient.
Right. And this is part of some of your current research, I believe. So the focus is cognitive and affective reflexibility and how these mechanisms affect psychological health and well-being. Can you elaborate a bit more on, yeah, on your work?
Maybe if I backtrack a little bit. So a lot of my early research was looking at negative cognitive biases. So the idea that people might have biases in attention. So the brain tunes in instantly to more negative material, or they interpret socially ambiguous information in a more negative rather than positive way. Or say memory biases, where people selectively remember more negative rather than more positive or more neutral material. Now, all of those things are really important. We know they are predictive of particularly anxiety and depression. So my research is very much focused on the negativity, if you like, of the biases. But more recently, I think what myself and several other people have begun to realise is that maybe it's not the negativity so much as just the kind of inflexibility of those biases. So in other words, anxious people tend to have a very strong negative bias, but they have that negative bias even in very safe situations. Whereas all of us, if we're in a slightly threatening situation, you know, imagine you wake up in the night and you hear a noise or something, or if you're in a particular area of town where it's dark and you're on your own and it is actually threatening, well, then it makes absolute sense to have a negative bias and to be hypervigilant. You know, it's absolutely appropriate. And that's why we have those kind of biases. They're very protective. But the problem is, it's people are more resilient and have a lot of flexibility. So they'll have those biases in the right context. But actually, when you're in a safe environment, you know, actually, you won't be particularly hypervigilant. And so I'm beginning to kind of realise or hypothesise, really, that maybe that's actually one of the big problems with anxiety, that it's not so much the negativity on its own, but rather that the bias is really inflexible. People get stuck into these very rigid ways of not only processing information, but also rigid ways of trying to cope. You know, we all know, we all do it, we all kind of keep trying to do the same thing, even though it's clearly not working. Whereas people who are prone to anxiety and depression often particularly get into that very rigid style of trying out the same thing over and over again, rather than kind of stepping back and just trying to be more flexible.
And how does that apply to children and young people? At what age do these patterns start to?
Well, we've just started. We've started doing a lot of work around this now, and there hasn't actually been too much empirical research on this. So we don't really know too much about these mechanisms in younger children. But I suspect they do start kind of relatively early. Although I think generally we know definitely that between the age of 7 and 11, cognitive flexibility actually does increase dramatically. So a 7 or a 6 year old will be pretty inflexible. If they're trying to solve a problem, they'll just keep trying to do the same thing. And then, you know, as they progress up to about 11 or 12, they'll just develop a lot more cognitive flexibility. But in terms of, if you like, applying that to emotional situations, we don't really know too much about that. And we've been looking at a large cohort of people who we followed over about a 4-year period. And we started at the age of 12, so they weren't very young, but they started in secondary school, really. And we followed them until they were about 16 or 17. And we've looked at some kind of measures of flexibility in that cohort. And we have another big study ongoing at the moment, which is funded by the ESRC. And that's specifically looking at cognitive flexibility in a teenage. Again, we're primarily looking at around 13 or 14 years of age.
Okay. And any interim findings that you can share?
We haven't really got too many results coming out with the adolescent population, but we have done some interesting studies with a first-year student population. So again, you know, people around 19 years of age. And I had a master's student a couple of years ago, Eve Twivy, who did a very interesting study where she followed just over 80 people for an 8-week period. Mm-hmm. So we measured their cognitive flexibility on a what we call a task switching task. So this is simply where people look at images on a computer screen and there's two judgments they have to make. So on some trials, they simply have to decide, is it a negative or a positive scene? Mm-hmm. So it might be highly positive or negative. On other situations, they have to say whether there's more or less than two people in the scene. And so what we look at the switch costs, as they're called, when you have to switch from one task to the other. So on one trial, you might have to say there's more than two people. And then the very next trial, you have to make an emotional judgment. And what you look at is there a difference in terms of how easily people can switch depending on the emotionality of the scene. And to be honest, what we had expected, what we'd hypothesized was that people who are more prone to worry and anxiety over time would be much more likely to have difficulty switching away from negative material, because there have been a number of studies that found that. And even though we found a trend for that, actually it wasn't particularly significant in this study. But what was really significant was that those people who were much more likely to be worried and anxious over the 8 weeks were actually showed a really strong inflexibility in shifting towards positive material, which I thought was really kind of interesting. Yeah. Really, really interesting. So it wasn't so much that there was a trend and that they tended to get stuck on the negative and, you know, it took a bit longer to pull their attention away. But actually the real action seemed to be in terms of switching towards positivity, which, you know, kind of was really interesting. And those people were also much more affected by kind of everyday hassles. So we gave people a measurement called the hassles and uplifts scale, which is pretty self-explanatory. Right. So it measures how many hassles are everyday things like missing your bus or, you know, minor kind of things. And likewise, uplifts as well, which are, again, minor things like bumping into a friend or having a nice bar of chocolate or something. And what we found was that people who were less flexible in terms of switching towards positive material were much more prone to worry and also were much more affected by these kind of daily hassles and weren't as protected by the daily uplifts, which I thought was kind of really interesting. Mm. So we're running another study now with another clinical psychology student, Holly Banfield. And Holly is basically trying to replicate that finding, but also trying to follow people over a much longer period. So we're actually following people up to 12 months.
Tell me about the Cog Bias project.
So I was lucky enough in 2013, I got a European Research Council Advanced Investigator Award, as they're called. And this is quite a big programme grant over a five-year period. And we actually got a one-year extension. So it just finished last October. Mm-hmm. So we had it for 6 years. Great. And it was called the Cog Bias project. And the aim of the project really was to bring together two literatures. So my own background has been very much looking at the role of these cognitive biases, particularly in relation to anxiety and depression. So we know, for example, the negative biases, as we said, in both memory, interpretation and attention can really have an adverse effect on the development of anxiety. And then I kind of discovered a number of years ago, I got interested in a literature looking at particular genetic variants that also seem to, increase risk for depression and anxiety. It's become a very controversial literature, but at the time there was a lot of excitement about this literature and that, you know, these genes were really seemed to predict. And what I realised was that both of these literatures were really asking exactly the same questions, whereas one was looking at cognitive biases, the other was looking at genetic variants. Mm-hmm. But actually there was hardly any overlap between them at all. You know, they didn't cite each other, they didn't really, people didn't know about the other literature. So the aim of this project was really to try and bring these two things together and really say that, you know, well, is it the case that if you have a particular, say, group of let's say you have, we're now actually calling them sensitivity genes rather than risky genes. Right. So genes that, if you like, kind of make you a little bit more sensitive to the environment. If you have those genes, the hypothesis is that might actually kind of facilitate the development of negative biases. Mm. So if you're in a negative environment, for example, you might develop a negative bias much more rapidly if you have these particular sensitivity genes, and that in turn then will lead into more anxiety and depression. So that was really the aim of the project, and we ended up with about five different projects. It was quite complex, really, but one of the big projects within there was this longitudinal study I've just been mentioned, which was following. We followed 504 12-year-olds until they're about 16 or 17, and we finished in wave. We tested them on three occasions over that period, roughly a year apart, a little bit more than a year apart. And we finally, we had 411, I think, was the number that finished in wave three, which is just a 19% dropout, which is actually pretty good. So I think the team did really well, I think, in actually making sure that we didn't get too big a dropout. And I think that's a really unique study because we took lots of self-report measures. We obviously took DNA samples, so we have full genome information for all of the children involved. But I think what makes it unique is we also have a wide range of behavioural measures of biases. So we measured biases in attention, in memory, in interpretation. We also looked at approach avoidance for food-related stimuli in relation to, say, binge eating. So we'd have subjective measures of binge eating and other eating behaviours. So it's a very rich data set, and I think we'll keep us going for years to come. We've obviously analysed quite a bit of the data, but even though the project is formally finished, we'll obviously be working on it for a long time in terms of the data set.
Right. And in terms of findings, what are the highlights?
I think the highlights, well, there's a couple of things. First of all, I suppose I thought I'd kind of mention maybe there's three kind of key projects that I could possibly mention, which we've kind of analysed pretty well. So during the project, there were three people who actually did their PhDs, or DPhils as they're called in Oxford. So one was Sam Parsons. So he did a very nice study looking at well-being. So, you know, psychological well-being really in this group of people. And he used a measure called the mental health continuum, which basically measures from kind of languishing at one end to flourishing at the other end. And what we find is that most people are kind of somewhere in the middle. Some people are kind of just getting by, but they're not particularly flourishing. But what Sam did was very interesting. He applied this statistical technique called network analysis, which really tries to look at the connections among different factors, whether they're bias measures or things like self-esteem or social factors, lots of different factors. And what we found was quite expected in terms of the people who were languishing. So these would be the people with relatively poor mental health, so high worry, high rumination. They had really, really tight and rich connections between the different biases. So they would tend to have a strong negative bias in how they interpret it. Ambiguous information, for example, and that would be very tightly linked to a bias in memory, for example. So the idea was that if one of those biases gets activated, the whole network can become activated very, very quickly. Whereas when we looked at people much higher on that kind of scale, so those who are more at the flourishing end, actually the connections were much, much looser. They're just, you could even see, it's a very visual diagram. You can see the diagram just looks like there's less connections. And so that was kind of really fascinating because we really thought, well, that's really interesting. And, you know, it really seems to indicate, or it is a little bit speculative, but what we're speculating is that, because the connections aren't as strong, that might actually give a lot more flexibility. So going back to what we were saying about the flexibility, that if you don't have that tightly connected, especially negative biases, it may give a lot more flexibility in reacting to different situations. So those kind of results partly were what sparked our new study with the ESRC, where we're specifically looking at flexibility. So that's the kind of really interesting study that Sam has written up, and it's under revision at the moment with the journal. So, and we're hoping that will be accepted, obviously. And then another, so Annabelle Sonko also did her PhD and is now working as a postdoc in my group. And she looked specifically at worry and anxiety in this cohort. And again, we found some really interesting results. So again, what she did was, in the literature, most of the research actually looks at biases fairly independently from each other. So you tend to find a lot of studies looking at just attention bias, other studies looking just at memory bias, others looking at interpretation bias, whereas we brought them all together, really. And the hypothesis was that the multiple biases would actually be more predictive of anxiety than just a single bias, and that's effectively what we found. So in Annabelle's analysis, she found that when she did a thing called a principal components analysis, so a PCA analysis, where you basically see what kind of fits together better. Mm-hmm. What she found was that biases in memory and biases in interpretation really linked together very closely. The attention measures we found weren't particularly reliable, unfortunately, throughout all our studies. So that tends to drop out of the statistical analysis a lot. But what Annabelle found was that what we're calling the polybias score, so the combined bias score, was much more predictive of anxiety and depression than the single bias on its own. So I think that was really kind of quite interesting. And the other thing, I suppose I could just look up, so we've just done a kind of an analysis looking across time of, you know, what happens with things like anxiety and depression and rumination. And first of all, I should say that in this cohort, so this is a very normative sample of school children. Mm-hmm. We had 10 different schools around the Oxfordshire area. And about 20% of those children actually had levels of anxiety, depression that reached kind of clinical cutoff. Wow. So this isn't a clinical diagnosis, but using the kind of standardized scales, the cutoffs that are generally seen as getting close to clinical levels was about 20%, which is about typical. It's about what you find nationally in big national surveys. But what we found interesting, so over that period of time from the age of 12 or 13 to the age of about 16, 17, we found no particular change in anxiety. But we did find a pretty significant increase in depression. So depression increased, and there was almost a hint in there of, you know, anxiety seemed to turn into depression as children got a little bit older, which I think has been found before as well. So that the very anxious 12-year-olds, often the anxiety wouldn't really change too much, but their level of depression would increase. And also we measured some of these so-called trans-diagnostic measures, which I think are particularly interesting, so things like worry and rumination, mm-hmm. Which is probably the same process. It's just right. Rumination looks back, really, and worry looks forward. So worry is about ruminating about what might go wrong in the future, whereas rumination tends to be more associated with depression, but it's thinking about all the bad things that happened in the past and failures in the past. Both of those really increased during this, quite dramatically, during this kind of period, which was a little bit of a worry. And self-esteem actually decreased. Mm. So while the 12-year-olds are pretty high in self-esteem, it gradually decreased as we went over that kind of age group. So basically, it was kind of worsening mood across that period from 12, 13 to about 16, 17, which is a bit of a concern. But as I said, it was quite interesting to see that in this kind of cohort. Mm. So another, Charlotte Booth, who's another PhD student in my group, who again then went on to work as a postdoc with us, and she's now actually in Imperial College in London. Mm-hmm. So she did a very nice study on this longitudinal study looking at resilience. So particularly looking at, you know, what were the factors that predicted right. more resilient children. And what she did was she used quite a new measure, which it hasn't been used too much at all, especially in adolescents. So it's a measure of, rather than giving a questionnaire, you know, as I said before, the idea that resilience is somehow a personality trait, I think has been fairly debunked now, really. So what she did was, we had quite a good measure of all of the different kind of good and bad things that happened to these children. So in the previous year, it was assessed on questionnaires. And what Charlotte did was found, using a thing called the residuals method, looking at who's doing better than expected relative to what had happened to them and who's doing worse than expected. So the idea is that resilient people aren't necessarily doing really well. You know, if they've been in really, like if you're a Syrian refugee, for example, mm-hmm. you know, if you're actually kind of pretty okay, a little bit depressed or anxious, you're probably actually extremely resilient. So, you know, you have to really look at what people have been through. So
it sounds like a much more accurate
measure. No, exactly. It's a much more accurate measure, So we took kind of the real events that people had happened and then looked at the regression lines, if you like, so who's doing better and who's doing worse. I think this is the first time this has been done where we also took cognitive biases into account as well, which I think was quite interesting. And basically what Charlotte found was that the kind of things that really predicted increased resilience were certainly self-esteem. So higher self-esteem, as you might expect, mm-hmm. was definitely linked to higher resilience. Lower levels of rumination and worry, which, as I said, we know are these kind of trans-diagnostic factors that we know can be quite toxic in terms of resilience. But instantly, also memory bias and interpretation bias. So the more the negative bias, the less resilient, basically, mm-hmm. people were. And that was particularly the case with memory bias. So memory bias was a unique predictor of resilience across this age group, which was really kind of quite interesting. And another couple of the protective factors was being male. So, I should say our outcome measure here was internalizing problems. So that's mm-hmm. anxiety and depression symptoms. So we do know that anxiety and depression is much more common in females mm-hmm. generally. So that's probably not overly surprising. So as we found, especially across development, you know, the girls tended to show more anxiety mm-hmm. and depression symptoms than the boys. So that came out as a factor within this residual analysis, where we found that actually being male was actually a protective mm-hmm. factor, and higher socioeconomic status likewise was a protective factor. So again, that's just been submitted for publication now as well. So as I said, a lot of this analysis is still ongoing. Right. So I think it will keep us going for quite a while. So
there's masses in the pipeline.
There is, yeah.
I wanted to ask you about polygenic risk scores. Is that the same as a polybias score that you
No, so that's separate? So the biases are just looking at the biases, mm-hmm. so the mm-hmm. kind of cognitive biases. So the polygenic risk scores are really looking at a whole range of genes that we know might be linked. Mm-hmm. So there are usually genes around the serotonin system and the dopamine system. Right. So the method we've been using is to look at the big studies called GWAS studies, which is genome-wide association studies. Mm-hmm. So these usually have about 20, 30, 40,000 people. So, you know, you need really big studies. So, for example, the latest depression polygenic risk score, I think, has been tested on about 300,000 people worldwide in a big consortium. So what they've done is they've picked out about 20 genes or so that mm-hmm. Particular variants are linked to depression in this big study. So it's almost like a kind of a psychometric scale, if you like. So you can work out the variance along these 20 or so different genes. So what we're doing is we're taking the latest polygenic risk score from the big GWAS studies mm-hmm. and then applying that in our data and saying, well, does this polygenic risk score actually explain, you know, a variance in our study? And what we found so far is that it definitely is linked, again, to our measures of anxiety and depression. We're just now looking at binge eating and eating behaviour, so we haven't really got results there yet. But what's really interesting is what we're finding is that some of the link between the polygenic risk scores mm-hmm. and, say, depression are completely moderated by interpretation biases. Oh, wow. So in other words, if people have, say, a highly sensitive genetic risk score, mm-hmm. we know that generally links with increased depression. But that's only the case if they have a very strong negative interpretation bias. If they don't have a strong negative interpretation bias, that relationship really decreases. Mm. So we're just writing that up at the moment, and we're actually trying to, because this whole area has become quite controversial, we're trying to make sure we replicate this in another sample. Mm-hmm. And the difficulty is we can't actually run that data ourselves because it's obviously another big 5-year study. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the big studies around don't have measures of biases, which is a problem. Mm-hmm. But there is one study, this Jenny Hudson and her team in Macquarie University in Sydney have done a study where they started just a year before us, actually. So we kind of collaborated on certain measures. So we made sure that we had some overlap with our measures. Mm-hmm. So we're hoping that we'll be able to replicate some of our findings on her data set, mm-hmm. where I think she's testing about 1,500 children in the Sydney school system. And so hopefully, if we replicate the same findings, I think they would be really quite exciting findings.
Yeah. And do you know, are the polygenic risk scores being used in clinical practice, or is it too early?
It is quite early, but there is a lot of there's a lot of really interesting research. So again, Professor Talia Ely in King's College here in London, she's doing some very interesting work looking at reaction to psychological therapies mm-hmm. using the same type of polygenic risk scores. And so the idea is that, again, if you're very sensitive, if you have a lot of these sensitivity mm-hmm. genes, for example, that might make you quite vulnerable in a very negative situation, but it also might mean that you might benefit more from things like psychological therapy. So she's already done some really interesting work indicating that, you know, there is some support for that notion. And they have a really big study going on at the moment where they're really trying to get a much, much bigger data set, including genetics, to really see is that the case? You know, is there a difference? So you can see, I think it's still kind of a long way off, but the idea would be that it using the genetic information might be a way of developing much more personalised treatments and personalised medicine, personalised psychology, if you like, which I think could be a real benefit in the future.
Yeah, it's very interesting, isn't it? You've recently been appointed as the National Mental Health Network Impact and Public Engagement Coordinator by the UK Department of Research and Innovation. What will you be doing in this role?
Yeah, well, it's a little bit of a mouthful, but it's a really interesting role, actually. I'm really excited about getting involved with this. So UKRI, about a year and a half ago or so, funded 8 different mental health networks around the country. So these are mental health research networks. And 4 of them are actually particularly focused on young people's mental health and mental well-being. And the idea behind the initiative really is it's quite a big investment from the UK Department of Research and Innovation. And the idea is really to try and genuinely change the landscape of mental health research by bringing in a much, much more interdisciplinary approach, and particularly bringing people with lived experience of mental health problems into the heart of the research process. So basically, UKRI funded these 8 networks. Each of them were awarded roughly around £1 million. So it was a big investment. And what UKRI are really keen to ensure is that these networks actually will collaborate with each other as much as possible and really just raise the profile of mental health research generally, both among researchers, but also among the general public and other charities and other funders. So they were a little bit concerned that this may not happen kind of organically. So they advertised for this role as a coordinator. So I put together a small team of people and applied for that. So the team I got together was a guy called Andre Tomlin, who is probably better known in the mental health field as Mental Elf. You may, if you're on Twitter, he's Mental Elf. Yeah. And so he's done a great job, I think, on presenting evidence-based information mm-hmm. around mental health. And then Vanessa Pinfold from the McPinn Foundation. And so they are a charity who are focused on mental health research, and their particular expert expertise is on making sure that people with lived experience are involved in mental mm-hmm. health research. Mm-hmm. So they're very much involved in the team. And then the third person is a woman called Sally Ann Kaiser, who I've known for a number of years. And she runs a TV production company called Sixth Sense Media. And the idea there is she's done a lot of work around young people's mental health and well-being and really good TV programs mm-hmm. around that. So the idea is that we've got two kind of remits, if you like. The first part of the job and my role really is to try and, first of all, make sure that we can try and facilitate the networks to work together as much as possible, where that makes sense. You know, so really looking into see are there particular areas where two or three or four networks might be able to work together quite productively. Mm-hmm. And then another big part of the role is to really start a kind of what we're calling a national conversation. So really mm-hmm. to try and do a little bit of awareness raising, if you like, around mental health research, because there's been a lot of really fantastic media coverage in the last couple of years around mental health generally. And I mm-hmm. think stigmas are decreasing. And I think there's been a lot of really interesting stuff going on. But actually, research has been missed out a little bit mm-hmm. in that there hasn't really been much about research. And we know, you know, there's another charity works in the UK, MQ, who are specifically linked with mental health research as well. And, you know, they've pointed out that actually the amount of research funding that goes into mental health is tiny compared to, right. say, cancer or heart disease or other physical diseases or physical health issues. So I think that's part of our remit is to try and really raise awareness and to really raise the importance of the research process mm. that to really provide better treatments. And as we were saying with the genetics, with more personalised treatments, in order to do that, we need a lot more fundamental right, research. Right. And of course, it is a very exciting time because the Wellcome Trust, for example, are already they've had a long investment in mental mm-hmm. health research, but recently they've really put a very large investment in. And again, you know, Miranda Walport has just taken over there as leading on the mental health side of the Wellcome Trust's agenda. So it is a very exciting time, mm-hmm. I think, to be in. And we just really want to try and, so our role is to try and make sure that all of these different groups work together as much as possible right. and try and have a coherent message. Really.
And why is it so important to have this highly collaborative research of this type?
Well, I think I think a real problem has been people really working in silos, if you like. Mm. So that, you know, there's been a lot of fantastic research going on. It is really good research, but particularly because people with lived experience, so people who are really mm. on the ground are having difficulties, or families who have people who are having mental health difficulties, because traditionally they haven't really been so involved in the research process. A lot of that research is a little bit divorced from people's everyday mm. lives. So when you look at the research, yeah, we've learned a huge amount. If you look at, say, neuroscience research or genetics research, lots of different types of research, cognitive stuff that I'm involved in, it's all really interesting. And I think we've learned a lot about how the brain works and how people react to different situations. But that still hasn't really got translated into therapies and into mm. interventions that can help to prevent mental health problems. So I think the idea is that really involving people who are actively, you know, have mental health problems, involving them in the research process will at least keep those things to the forefront mm-hmm. of people's minds. But also, I think generally, because I think what we all kind of acknowledge now is that the mental health isn't one of these problems that has a single cause or even a small group of causes. There's, you know, you can end up being extremely, say, depressed or anxious for a wide variety of different reasons. It may be because of social deprivation. Mm-hmm. It may be because of some hormonal imbalance. It may be a biological reason. You know, there's multiple reasons, but often you end up with the same type of symptoms. So I think what's happened is a lot of the research has been in these silos looking right. at individual causes but not taking in the complexity of it. So the idea really is to say, well, let's actually take that on board. Let's look at this as a much more complex human mm-hmm. problem that involves society at large, as well as biological factors and social factors mm-hmm. and lots of other factors. And I think by getting everyone together, the hope is that actually we'll end up with much more realistic mental health science.
Right. And what more can be done to raise the public profile and quality of mental health research in the UK?
I think really just getting that message out there that research is really important, and that actually there is a lot of research going on, because I think there really has been a gap in awareness there. As I said, there's been a lot of fantastic campaigns by Heads Together and lots of others, but the focus has been very much on services and what services, and again, quite rightly, because that's something that definitely needs to be improved. But really, there's been very little about the actual research and what kind of research is needed. So I think just really getting that on the agenda, and as part of my role with UKRI and the mental health networks, that's very much what we're hoping to do with this kind of, we don't want to call it a campaign, but a kind mm-hmm. of a national conversation mm-hmm. really around how can we improve research, how can we really get lots of people involved in research, particularly facilitating pathways for younger people to get involved mm-hmm. in research, and hopefully just, you know, trying to normalise the whole situation, and that in turn would hopefully decrease stigma around mm-hmm. mental health problems. Mm-hmm. And for example, a lot of some of the networks are very involved with young people, and they have very good youth advisory panels, for example, which are led, and it gives a very, very different perspective when you've got a group of, say, 14 or 15-year-olds who are actually advising on how research should be conducted.
Mm. Elaine, what else is in the pipeline that you'd like to mention?
A big project for me on a personal level is I've just agreed to write a second popular science book. So I wrote a book a couple of years ago called Rainy Brain, Sunny Brain, which is really about my own research on genetics and cognitive biases and in relation to anxiety and depression, and really enjoyed that whole process of engaging the public with the science. Mm. And I think there was a great appetite among the public for science, particularly around young people's mental health and mental well-being. And so actually, as part of my ERC grant, I was supposed to spend about 30% of my time writing a popular book, mm-hmm. an accessible book on this. I did make a start and stopped and started a bit, but it was such a big team. Mm-hmm. You can imagine I just got kind of overloaded. So I'm really now focused on that. So I'm working on a book. It's called Switchcraft, which I have to thank my husband for the title, which I think is quite a nice title. And it's really looking at mental flexibility and the importance of flexibility, especially in relation to resilience. Mm. So really kind of going through the literature and obviously in a very accessible way, to really say, well, actually, what is the evidence that inflexibility is linked to a wide range of mental health problems? And if we do become more flexible in terms of how we cope with situations, does that actually enhance our resilience? And then are there ways we can actually develop our flexibility? Mm. So I'm really kind of primarily in my spare time trying to write that, but really that's going to be a big focus over the next year or so.
And who's the target readership? Would it be
it's a general public? Everybody, hopefully. It's very much aimed at a very general group of people, but certainly hopefully the teenagers themselves, but probably primarily parents and people who enjoy popular science. And the idea is it will just make the science behind this whole area very accessible, and just in terms of, you know, anybody who needs to know a bit more about how you can cope with setbacks and cope with life in general. And I suppose part of the idea behind the book is that, you know, we live in a really volatile world, in a quite a precarious type of world, particularly recently with Brexit here and with the Trump administration in the States. There's a lot of precariousness and the coronavirus and everything, all of that going on, and I think a lot of people really feel very vulnerable in those kind of very changeable situations. So it's really looking at how people can develop their flexibility in those very changeable situations.
Elaine, finally, what is your takeaway message for those listening to our conversation?
I think my main takeaway would be for people to really think about, can they get involved in mental health research in some way? And I think that's certainly with this role with UKRI and with the mental health networks, what we're really hoping to do is really provide opportunities for people, all sorts of people, very young people, you know, people who don't necessarily have any academic qualifications, but people who feel they have something to contribute to research in some way. So I'd really encourage people to try and have a look at the network's websites, try and see, is there a way they could get involved? Because I think, and again, just in terms of generally trying to decrease stigma around mental health, particularly in young people, I think even now, even though the stigma has decreased a lot, I think a lot of people are still very nervous about acknowledging mental health problems. And so I think really just trying to, if you're an employer or if you're a parent or a school teacher, just trying to provide a place, if you like, where people can really feel free, feel they won't be judged harshly if they admit that they have mental health problems. And I know, for example, in my own university in Oxford, but I think probably most universities, there's a lot of people in lab groups who are really nervous about admitting they have mental health problems because they just really feel that will affect badly on them. And, I think it's just a general culture change. We really need to change the culture around mental health generally.
And for people who want to get involved, do you have the website address?
The website name is mentalhealthresearchmatters.org.uk.
Elaine, thank you ever so much. It was really fascinating. For more details on Professor Elaine Fox, please visit the ACAM website, www.acam.org, and Twitter at ACAM. ACAM is spelled A-C-A-M-H.
This podcast was brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short.